Hi, welcome to Holistic Matters Podcast. I'm your host, John Trope. It's the podcast that's designed to give you information to help you become the you that nature intended. Today, I'm excited to be with Dr. Jay Lombard. Jay has a very influential career in integrative and functional medicine. He's been a practicing neurologist for 25 years and is one of the original faculty members for the Institute for Functional Medicine, developing a curricula and education materials around neurosciences. Dr. Lombard is the co-founder and chief innovation officer of Genomind and the founder and medical director of Mindful DNA, and continues to practice neuroscience and neurology in New York City. Dr. Lombard, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, John. It's always a pleasure to talk to you, catching up. Thank you.
Great. So today we wanted to talk a little bit about stress and then how that leads to problems of anxiety and ultimately complicates underlying inflammation and, you know, to become the domino effect. But what's your original approach to suggesting to practitioners on how to get their arms around this concept of stress, and what are the key complicating components that you think are most important to be able to recognize and understand?
Yep, there's a lot to unload there in that question. So I think, you know, first of all, I'd like to see people kind of shift their description of functional medicine to what functional medicine really is, which is systems biology, and explain systems biology in relationship to stress, because stress is probably at the fulcrum of systems biology, since it affects every organ system. And I think if we step back and think about stress as being both a biological as well as a phenomenological, meaning an experiential event that we all are subjected to, I could tell you that when I lecture at conferences, people most often ask questions about their own personal health issues rather than their own patients. So I think it's good to kind of step back and just think about this in terms of ourselves, and then also using that information to apply to patients. And what I mean by that is that stress is both a top-down, bottom-up dysfunction of systems biology. Top-down means that we creating a maladaption to whatever stressors we have in our lives. So we need to understand, first of all, that stress starts at the perceptual level, how we interpret stress, what the value of stress can be, but also the detriment of stress. And the detriment of stress, I think, is when we take the bottom-up approach, meaning how do we understand stress is physiological as much as psychological? What are the physiological, you know, points that lead from a dysfunctional state to a disease state? So I think there's a lot to unpack in your question.
Yeah. Well, maybe we can tease some of that out. Let me step back for a second, too. And we've noticed in a recent analysis of patients in integrative medicine that about 80% of them present with this complaint of stress and anxiety. And yep. As we dug deeper into trying to look at that profile, about 90% of those have some kind of underlying problem with inflammation and a complaint of pain. And so it's really a complicated issue. And so I guess to your description, maybe we could try to unpack or tease out at least the physiological problems. And maybe the question is an exposure to stressors in our everyday life, is that a contributing cause to inflammation, or is it a complication to underlying inflammation and problems with health?
It's a reciprocal issue that I think what we have to understand is that inflammation is the translation of a psychological state, and inflammation also causes the psychological state. So they're really two sides of the same coin. What happens in a very simple way is that the stress response is normally designed for short-term acute reactions to a stressor. So if we're, you know, living 2,000 years ago, and a lion, you know, jumps out of the forest and attacks us, We have stress for a couple of hours, and then at the end of the event, if we've not gotten eaten, we kind of, laugh about it, talk about how the lion ran away from us, yada, yada, yada. But unfortunately, living in 2018, stress is it's really unmitigated. We have constant low-grade stress, and that is the worst type of biological experience because our bodies are not adapted to those types of unmitigated stress. So really, I think the first step, and this, by the way, is something that I've had to learn myself. It's not very easy to either to absorb or to implement in oneself, let alone to a patient, is to understand what the value of stress is. There obviously are positive physiological benefits of stress when used in a short-term fight-or-flight response. Stress only becomes pathological when it becomes unmitigated and constant. And that's when we have inflammation. And after inflammation, we have neurodegeneration. Metaphorically, think about the fire that doesn't go out. And depending upon our genetics, which I think is an important thing to bring up in our discussion here, each person has a more common stress point. But all of those stress points are immune-mediated, and they're mediated through, MER-181, which is one of the key effector steps that actually determines how the immune system reacts to stress.
So when you describe these stressors, and especially in your description, as it leads to, potentially if untreated, right, leads to even what you described, I think, as neurodegenerative problems. What should the practitioner look for, other than the obvious signs while they're looking at the patient? I mean, are there diagnostic tests, as an example, or blood markers that can be used to help tease the seriousness and the extent of where stress has really complicated underlying systems of the body?
Well, I think it's a very noisy field, meaning that there are lots of companies and technologies that are offered to clinicians that can help or actually cloud what they're seeing clinically for patients. We know that DNA sets sort of the vocabulary of our inheritance, but RNA really determines the expression of DNA. And at the crossroads of DNA and RNA sit these MER with different numbers, but 181 is one of the key effectors that determines how a DNA becomes transcribed through RNA. So it's a very good marker. It was identified as a SNP by Kerry Ressler at McLean Hospital a couple of years ago. And very interestingly, that people that had a certain variant of MER-181 were more resilient to stress. About 30% of us, myself not included, by the way, have the positive mutation, if you will, that are much more resilient to stress and actually have better coping mechanisms than those who don't have this variant of MER-181. But that doesn't help those that don't have it, right? So we need to understand what is the pathological abnormalities that occur in that mutation that leads to reduced resilience in patients that have MER-181 variants that make them more prone to stress. And that leads us back to the immune system. They have heightened immune reactions. They may have higher C-reactive protein or selectin or MMP9 or some other inflammatory markers. But we just know in general that not only are they more inflamed, they're also more prone to develop chronic disease alongside their stress.
Right. So it sounds like from your description, there's a lot, and that's the good news, there's a lot that can be done to help manage these patients. Some of it can be nutrition. For example, you mentioned MER-181, and that's a PMG. But are there other nutrients now in the marketplace? I've heard you talk about hemp oil in the past and a variety of other nutrients, but between lifestyle improvement, lifestyle balance, and nutritional support, what's your short list of effective approaches to managing this issue?
Well, I think CBD oil is one of the best anti-inflammatories that we have available to us. I'm sort of an anti-THC person. The whole medical marijuana field there's this big debate about THC versus CBD. CBD clearly has anti-inflammatory effects, not only systemically, but in the brain itself. There are what are called glial cells, which are the white blood cells of the brain, that possess what are called CB2 receptors that CBD binds to and downregulates. So CBD is an excellent anti-inflammatory and a very, very safe anxiolytic agent. And it's been, you know, quite useful in many clinicians' hands. And you know, now it's available as an OTC and dietary supplement. I think more and more people are being exposed to it. And people are finding out, you know, different ways of combining CBD to enhance or augment its effects with, you know, better absorption. Examples are like medium-chain triglycerides that really help, you know, convert CBD to anandamide, which is one of the, you know, the blissful neurotransmitters that we like to get when we partake in marijuana. So that you know, the medium-chain triglycerides would be another short list of compounds I would consider for stress. So when I give lectures to, you know, integrative medicine doctors, we have to think about stress being a two-way street. We need more jet fuel in the morning, meaning we need to increase our cortisol levels, increase, you know, our norepinephrine, our dopamine, sort of the adrenaline neurotransmitters to cope with stress in the AM, and we need a sort of an opposite portfolio of products in the PM. So there's sort of, I would say, two broad-based lists that we need, you know, one for AM stress management and a second for stress PM management. And those are different categories. So, you know, we can go on about those, but I think my favorite adaptogens, but ashwagandha is an excellent example of a very well-validated, both clinically and basic science, adaptogen that both reduces inflammation in the brain and has, you know, anxiolytic effects, as well as libido-enhancing effects, which is quite interesting. But why we probably should use it, you know, in the evening as opposed to the morning. Otherwise, people won't get their work done properly. But,
right.
You know, AM AM compounds like rhodiola, which increase dopamine, are excellent adaptogens for stress. But again, when used properly and based upon the circadian rhythms.
Yeah, great. How about lifestyle? You know, people talk about things like yoga or meditation. Is that also kind of a, let's call it a co-therapy? I mean, are those kinds of tools helpful in conjunction with some of the other solutions you just described?
I think the greatest chasm in medicine in 2018 is between chiropractors, naturopaths, acupuncturists, massage therapists, and DOs on one side, and allopathic medicine and electronic medical records on the other, meaning that laying of hands is not something, you know, that you can say is spiritual or you know, holistic. It is a vital component of healing. Just the tactile event of a doctor taking a patient and holding their hand through a procedure is something that our great Western medicine in our rush to quantify and to electronically identify data in the absence of human contact is the greatest tragedy in my lifetime. And the good news is that we still have practitioners that understand that the greatest thing we can give our patients is that human contact. So I'm not biased towards, you know, osteopathy versus chiropractic versus acupuncture versus massage therapy. You know, I am very biased, though, in terms of either the absence or the presence of a doctor physically who makes eye contact and also understands a patient at every level of the experience, including laying of hands of that patient. So it's a big, big personal issue I have in healthcare, why I actually love speaking to chiropractors and DOs. And naturopaths, because I think they understand that more implicitly, because EMR, I think, has just detracted from that essential aspect of holistic medicine.
Yeah, right. Any other suggestions that you might give practitioners as they consider patients, you know, with these challenges in care? We talked a little bit about nutrition, talked about stressors, talked about lifestyle balance. Any other insights and suggestions that you'd recommend? be
Well,
considered?
from my personal note, I can tell you that I've just started Pilates. I think Pilates is a great methodology. And the core aspect of Pilates, which is the same as in yoga, is to spend, 3 or 5 minutes a day, but teaching this as a clinician first to your patients about how to breathe properly using diaphragmatic muscles, and slowed breathing. It's something that a lot of the psychiatrists that do alternative medicine, like Richard Brown and others have taught as well. It's such a simple technology that we know increases serotonin, helps us sleep, and reduces anxiety, and is low cost, low tech, but highly effective to reduce stress in patients who experience stress.
Great. In a little bit more detail, what effect and links of stress to, say, the HPA axis and adrenal dysfunction or thyroid dysfunction, are they also related where a practitioner who's trying to manage a patient with stress and underlying inflammation also want to take a look at those systems?
I think going back again to that word systems biology, Genomind has done a very, very good job of being able to identify sort of the core buckets of systems biology based upon, our stress vulnerability. So, most of us have cardiovascular risk factors that we can identify genetically. We can identify gastrointestinal risk factors, which obviously is probably the biggest trigger for immune system dysfunction occurs in the gut. We know that there's, more than a trillion bacteria that overwhelm our defense systems when we're under stress. And those bacteria produce RNA that has an effect on our cells like our own RNA does. So again, miR-181 is a very, very important biomarker to identify for stress resilience. But other biomarkers that are in the, cardiovascular realm, the immune realm, the GI realm, obviously inflammation, these are all sort of, I look at these as clues, if you will, to find the smoking gun. And the smoking gun is the relationship or the balance between the endocrine system, the immune system, and the brain. So all the steps that we can take that are non-pharmaceutical are really, when you boil them down, quite simplistic, but they're also very complicated in terms of their physiology. And we could talk a lot about those, but obviously it's a short podcast. But we could probably talk about each organ system and how biomarkers can be used to identify those stressors and what specific non-pharmaceutical treatments one can consider to reduce stress based upon the identification of those biomarkers as well.
Right. So in your 25-plus years of practicing neurology, have you seen a consistent annual increase in the level of stress of patients and having to spend more time managing just that issue?
I think that we have not separated the forest from the trees. I think that one of the negative aspects of medicine in general, and this goes, to functional as well as just pharmacology, is that we've reduced this to its molecular substrate, which is very important to understand, but we at the same time lose the forest from the trees, and that forest obviously is a patient's experiential event of their lives. Clearly to me, the best suggestion I could give people, including in my own life, I'm talking out of personal experience here, not just as a physician, which is that having a greater sense of purpose and value of what we're doing in our lives is the key buffer against the effects of stress. There's no way we can avoid stress in our life today. The world itself is inflamed with global warming and pollution, toxins, and everything going on in the world. It's just these stressors are ubiquitous. What I tell people and my own family is turn the television off. Turn your cell phone off at least one day a week to avoid any exogenous stressors so that you can kind of reset your own barometer and find your higher self in that process.
Right. Well, so what do you do? A lot of our listeners are living across the United States, but I think probably all of us would agree is that New York City must be the epicenter of luck, and you're living there. I mean, so what do you do to try to manage being exposed to it on a daily basis?
Are we still being recorded? I'm actually looking to
Yeah.
move to I don't know, let's see, Wisconsin is a good choice for me, maybe North Carolina, maybe Puerto Rico, California, maybe, yeah, New York is, for a guy like me who's very sensitive, I think I have a condition called synkinesia, which means I feel other people's pain as much as my own. And living in New York is not the best place to hear sirens going off every 30 seconds in your life. So for anyone, any of your listeners who live in New York, I would say that, choose your residence carefully. Because when I meet all the Northwest folks, all the naturopaths who, they're all in the Seattle and the Northwest area that are big fans. They're so relaxed, they're like living in a different country. They're like, hey, dude, just why don't you open your practice up here? Oh yeah, like to pull my kids out of school and just like up, my whole entire life. But yeah, that would be a good first suggestion, is to find a place that's not as stressful as New York to live, Hundred percent agree with that one, John.
Well, great. So, this is Holistic Matters. We're talking about stress today with the most influential leader in integrative medicine on the topic of stress and anxiety and neurosciences, Dr. Jay Lombard. Thanks for taking the time to join us.
This podcast features the song New Day by Lee Rosevere, licensed under a Creative Commons Attribution License. If you like this podcast, please share with your friends and family. And don't forget to subscribe on iTunes. We'll see you next time on Holistic Matters, where we're talking about being the you that nature intended.